Scaremorphism is not a familiar word to most of you, with perhaps, well, with certainly the exception of Professor Borsholm here and any other archaeologists who might be around. So what I'm going to do, first of all, is my intention is to extend the possible analytical uses of this primarily archaeological concept into a descriptive category for both natural and artistic and therefore literary processes. So I'm going to explain the concept to you first of all, its history, its usage, and the state of the art, and then I'll show you hopefully how it might aid our understanding of the uses of quotation. The term, as it is presently used, refers to a fashioning of artifacts in a form which is appropriate to another medium, and so to the migration of a form proper to the construction of an artifact in one material to a replica of the same artifact constructed in another, usually less valuable, material. We see instances of this process, and don't worry if you didn't get it the first time, I'm going to explain in many different ways. We see instances of this process in pottery jugs from Zaire, as described by George Bassala in his book The Evolution of Technology, where the slight and non-functional handles high on the necks of pottery jugs are in fact survivals from handles made of cord. So you see on the left here the originals with cord handles, and on the right the later survivals. The jugs themselves are copies of more durable metal ones. Now, the utility of the concept in archaeology is that it allows for the identification of a function hidden behind what has become mere ornament in the process of transfer from one medium to another. We might observe that the process of producing replicas in another material also involves the use of a technique inappropriate to that material. For example, and most famously, the use of metalworking techniques in the production of pottery. Yet this definition of the concept includes only cultural artifacts and their static qualities. The Oxford English Dictionary defines skeuomorphism as the use of one material to give the appearance of another. And its first definition is an object or feature copying the design of a similar artifact in another material. The etymology given is from the Greek, skeos, meaning a container or a vessel or an implement, plus morphe. But the OED, I can't remember, no I didn't, right. But I put these down later on in my presentation. The OED also gives a secondary definition of skeuomorph, and this is it. An ornamental design resulting from the nature of the material used or the method of working it. And this process is what the illustration here describes and demonstrates. I wish to expand this concept to include a wider set of cultural activities, for in its ability to identify a transitional process between functional and aesthetic forms, skeuomorphism, it seems to me, may be a factor in the genesis of style in the fine arts and in literature more generally. If we abstract from the concept of skeuomorphism a general principle, that where a function is rendered obsolete, its residual traces become ornament, we might observe that such a principle obtains widely both in nature and in culture. The human body, for example, is a catalogue of skeuomorphs. Hair, no longer having the survival value that it did for our ancestors, now serves primarily an ornamental role. Fingernails are painted. Nipples are pierced. These practices, in their decorative aspects, also serve new cultural functions. So, hair, for example, may serve as a marker of tribal or religious allegiance, of descent or conformity. Nails serve to indicate gender, in particular their length and their paint, but they also are used to distinguish social status, the manual worker set against the one who can afford not to work. Not all such organic skeuomorphs are generally visible. So, for example, the vermiform appendix is, as with the coccyx, the palmaris and subclavius muscles, and even wisdom teeth, are not regarded generally as ornamental in any sense. Yet where these organs are visible, they become overlaid with secondary symbolic significance, and their redundancy is usually emphasized by further decoration or by anomalous function. I don't know if anybody here can wiggle their ears. I cannot. I wish I could to demonstrate. The ability to wiggle your ears, if you can do so, is thanks to the possession, the anomalous possession, of extrinsic ear muscles, which most of us now no longer possess. It would originally have helped us to hear, as dogs, for example, can control the movements of their ears. Nevertheless, even where scleromorphs take on an ornamental role, the evidence of original function still remains coded into their form. There is no transfer from one medium to another here, but the shift in function of any organ demarcates a real phylogenic shift and refers to genuine transitions in the intensive relation of a species and its environment. Such vestigial organs have often been studied within an evolutionary framework and as often have been misunderstood as the continuing myth that the human embryo develops, then transforms into ears, residual gills, which formation is merely the brachial arch attests. This theme of vestigiality appears in literature most commonly during the second half of the 19th century, particularly in those pictures of Samuel Butler and H.G. Wells that take issue directly with the evolutionary analogy. Not a great deal has been written on scleromorphism in general. The most recent thorough theorisation of the concept is to be found in Michael Vickers and David Gill's book Artful Crafts in 1994. But their consideration is purely within an archaeological framework of its application to Greek ceramic imitations of metal vessels from the 6th to the 4th century before Christ. Michael Vickers describes his German volume on Scleromorphismus oder die Kunst aus wenig viel zu machen, which he published in 1999, as an examination of the concept of skeuomorphism, the principle whereby expensive materials such as gold, silver or rock crystal are imitated in cheaper ones such as bronze, pottery or glass. And he provides yet another definition of the term. He gives the migration of a form native to one medium into another. Richard M. Bailey has noted the traces of metal working elements upon stone Anglo-Saxon crosses, such as stone studs. He has suggested that such stone studs emulate both the jewelling of metal crosses, which use of valuable material served as an appropriate glorification of God and as an imitation of the Crux Gemata, itself a transfiguration of the true cross, as the 7th century Anglo-Saxon poem The Dream of the Rood memorialises. This is the 11th century Lotharkreuz, made in Cologne and now in Aachener Dom. I don't, sadly, have any pictures of the Anglo-Saxon stone imitations, but they look very similar, except the studding where the gems are is merely emulated into the carving of the stone. David A. Hinton suggests that those who made the original objects of emulation in this period, Anglo-Saxon smiths, might have been both excluded and revered as, I quote, those who have the knowledge to change metals into objects may have other powers ascribed to them. But also, and more sensibly, a popular fear of their magic might understandably be reduced to a sensible precaution against fire. If you live in a village, you exclude the smith, you pass all him off because, well, he plays with fire. It seems to me that we have a useful kind of point of intersection here between the attitudes towards Smiths and what I'm going to come towards the end of my paper, modern attitudes towards authors. Authors also, in their own way, play with fire and are both revered and excluded very often. The archaeologist Carl Neppert has discussed the application of skeuomorphism to modern photography and film, but only briefly and in one paper. Like many of the writers currently working on the development of material cultural studies from fledgling discipline into a mature science of the artificial, Neppert's work is concerned primarily with how we derive meaning from objects and theorises skeuomorphs within a semiotic framework borrowed from C.S. Peirce. Elsewhere, works dealing primarily with architecture and with computer software engineering have recently taken up the concept to describe specific problems within their own fields. Philip Stedman's book, The Evolution of Designs, views the concept as one of many, possibly fundamentally flawed, analogies with biology. Although his concern is principally with architectural manifestations, he identifies some of the wider philosophical difficulties of identifying ornament with absence of function. Anders Mauch, although he misunderstands the etymology of skeuomorphism completely, he thinks the word stems from skew. He uses skeuomorphism to describe the junk surplus functions or remnants of once functional machine language left behind in so-called bloatware. That is, the vastly overinflated software in common usage, such as, for example, Microsoft's Word, with which all of you are familiar except Apple users, I guess, where each successive generation of development of the product fails to eliminate the previous version's redundant functions and develops a vast mass of non-functional machine code. Stuart Brand also touches on skeuomorphism, architectural skeuomorphs, in his 1994 book, How Buildings Learn, What Happens After They're Built. Generally, however, skeuomorphs are only used within the archaeological context. But it is instructive to note that its earliest adherents place it within a much wider morphological system. Alfred Haddon's 1895 book, Evolution in Art, sees it as merely one type of morphism in an entire classificatory system of form in mainly savage artworks. Most of his terms derive from the object of representation, hence biomorph is divided into zoomorph, phylomorph, anthropomorph, as I've diagrammed here. Yet the addition of skeuomorphism permits Haddon to identify a type of form by the process of its genesis, so that he is able to account for a non-human agency determining certain forms. Haddon's memorable formulation of skeuomorphism as the annihilation of the useful by the beautiful suggests that what is needed to resolve the concept is the very opposite of the current academic trend, especially in the humanities. What is needed is an account of the relation between form and function, which focuses not upon meaning, but on morphogenesis. This is, for example, one of the issues I would take with those scholars like Carl Neppert, who look at skeuomorphism in relation to material culture, but read it through the lens of semiotics. At this stage, the question of the validity of the biological analogy becomes rather pressing. Philip Stedman's careful distinction in The Evolution of Designs between Darwinian natural selection and Lamarckian cultural evolution requires modern reassessment, as even in the year it was published, evidence of reticulate evolution in biology was becoming available. I do not intend here to explore this problem, though it is worthwhile considering the extent to which a skeuomorphology would obey the evolutionary principle that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Or, in other words, the principle that each single organism develops in stages which follow the same order as the evolutional stages of the species to which it belongs. A few examples to clarify. In biology, examples of this principle would include the fact that vertebrate mammal embryos develop the backbone first. In human embryos, the cerebrum develops last. It would seem that human biological skeuomorphs, such as the coccyx, do obey this principle also. The coccyx, or rather in embryo, what will become the coccyx, first develops into an embryonic tail at the same stage as it does in primate embryos, and only later in humans does it recede, becoming the residual coccyx. I would propose, furthermore, that there is a suggestive and productive continuity between skeuomorphism and, to touch on morphometer's interests, as I see them, Richard Dawkins' theory of memes. As skeuomorphs may be categorised within Dawkins' schema as physical instantiations of memes. And as Morch, whom I disparaged earlier for misunderstanding the etymology of the term, summarises Dawkins' notion of memes in suggestive terms to me in his article Evolutionary Growth and Control in User-Tailorable Systems. And I quote it here. Memes are the ideas embedded in cultural artefacts from books to pottery. They have a code that can be reused, i.e. described by a language, expressed, presented as readable sentences, and accessible to bodies in their environment, e.g. human readers. In the same way a gene can replicate to form new cells, a meme can become part of new artifacts. An example of this is when an idea that has been introduced in a book is found again in later in another book. This can be explained as the meme's capability for replication and survival. Memes combine and accumulate in a similar way to how genes combine and accumulate, by reproduction and inheritance. So, to take concrete examples of memes, if people don't remember the meme fetish in the early 90s and late 80s, as Dawkins' theory was infecting the humanities, memes account for fashions. Somebody starts wearing their trousers rolled up, and this fashion may infect other people, work virally. But to take a concrete example, some of you, not very many of you, are wearing jeans. If you're wearing Levi's jeans, I'm not, but I still have it. If you're wearing Levi's jeans, you'll notice that there's a small pocket here within the outside right-hand pocket. In Levi's, it is... why didn't I wear my Levi's? It's so stupid. In Levi's, it's fixed with rivets. If you look at the button at the top of the fly on a pair of Levi's, you will observe that the form of the button actually imitates the form of the rivets. The button does actually rivet, although it does not need to look like a rivet. What we have here is a series of obsolete functions. The small pocket, for example, is to contain a pocket watch, though I hardly think that any of us any longer still wear pocket watches. And stylized imitations of functions, such as occurs with the button. So let me here summarise, at the midpoint, the characteristic attributes of skeuomorphs and give you again those definitions before moving to the way in which literature can be understood and described through a skeuomorphology. So here are the two OED definitions I gave you earlier. An object or feature copying the design of a similar artifact in another material, and an ornamental design resulting from the nature of the material used or the method of working it. And I've also added to that Michael Vicker's supplementary definition, the migration of a form native to one medium into another. To me, to sum up, the characteristic attributes of skeuomorphs therefore appear to be, number one, their essential vestigiality. Number two, their ornamental form, which is the residue of an obsolete function. And number three, their capacity for self-replication. As this logic may be applied equally to the evolution of the non-organic and the artificial as to the organic, I would suggest that we might at this point consider the instances of such a logic in literature at three levels of form, language, and genre. For example, number one, form. In poetry, end rhyme has long since lost its primary function of helping the reciter to remember what comes next in the order of the poem. As we no longer have solely oral poetry. With writing came a vast shift, and end rhyme might now be described as a skeuomorph, an artifact which has lost its function and acquired ornamentality. Despite this essential vestigiality, however, it possesses still a remarkable capacity for self-replication and survival. Number two, it is evident that a similar principle obtains at the level of language, as linguists and etymologists will know well. There is some connection here between the archaeological usage of skeuomorph to mean ornament that is the residuum of function, and, for example, Gregory Bateson's comments on expressions which refer to mechanical homologies. Gregory Bateson, for example, reminds us of the term horsepower, where the engine of a car sits at the front of the car, where the horse pulling the carriage used to be. I was also reminded of this yesterday by Professor Wirth's comment on cut and paste, which also seems to me to memorialise an original function. It seems to be a term in transition, and very soon there will be a generation for whom the original meaning of cut and paste is completely lost. The vestigial, and on to my third example, the vestigial functions of mannerisms or styles in literary and artistic genres, where the style emerges from a prior but now redundant function, might best be illustrated by the traditional dramatic monologue. I'm thinking of Robert Browning, for example. The traditional dramatic monologue functions by creating in the reader a tension between sympathy for and moral judgment of the poem's fictional speaker, the persona. Later dramatic monologues in the 20th century, imitations of Browning, for example, Ezra Pound's modernist imitations, inherit this formal function of sympathy for and moral judgment of. But the moral response, which a 19th century poet such as Robert Browning might reasonably have anticipated from a Victorian reader, can no longer be relied on by poets such as Pound. Indeed, such a moral response is not even desirable. As a consequence, the form of the modernist dramatic monologue contains a skeuomorphic element, which both memorialises an obsolete relation of shared moral expectation between poet and reader, and which becomes in later poetry mere ornament. How then might we consider quotations and citations from the point of view of a skeuomorphology? I would begin by noting the intersection between the skeuomorphic notion of dead function or obsolete function and Bakhtin's notion of dead quotations. Bakhtin complains about, in the dialogic imagination, and I quote, "dead quotation something that falls out of the artistic context. For example, the evangelical texts in Tolstoy at the end of Resurrection. For Bakhtin, these quoted materials migrated from one form to another are dead because they fail to be integrated into the work that quotes them. His choice of adjective is to me particularly stimulating, as poetry since the Romantic era has been concerned with a connection between quotation and death, and often focuses upon the specifically memorialising function of quotation upon ornaments. I will refer you here to Shelley's Ozymandias, which I hope is too familiar for me to have to read. Shelley's ruined statue of Ozymandias, with its inscribed pedestal, is perhaps the most famous example. I'm thinking of these lines here. And on the pedestal of the statue, these words appear, quote, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." In the poem, the poet quotes a traveller. Note how, in the opening line, the poet is speaking of a traveller who then begins a narrative within the poem. The poet quotes a traveller who quotes the inscription he read upon the pedestal, which inscription is itself a quotation of Ozymandias' own original words. The recursiveness here only amplifies our sense of the quotation's obsolete function. Its new ornamental role within the picturesque ruins is to ironise the original meaning. It is worth noting that Shelley's poem is also a frame narrative, an intrinsically architectural form which permits all kinds of citations, from extended internal quotation to found manuscripts, real and imagined. The frame is a metaphor, but as such, it refers to the point of entry into the text. It is, if you like, a proscenium arch, a gate, a portal through which the reader must pass. And actual portals, too, as monuments, are frequently vehicles for quotations. As Dante's most famous inscription upon the gates of hell bears witness, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." This connection between monuments, quotation, and death infects the English novel throughout the Romantic period, a period during which both extended use of paratextual elements and the Gothic novel develop simultaneously. The most notoriously paratextual text of all, Thomas Frognall Dibdin's 1809 frame narrative Bibliomania, or Book Madness, a bibliographical romance, though ostensibly a narrative about bibliomanic disease, is composed primarily of peritextual matter, seemingly endless and lengthy quotations and citations, quotations of quotations and footnotes of footnotes referring to and even containing library and book auction catalogues, price lists, typographical and printing information, quasi-autobiographical interventions and anecdotes, analyses of indices, prefaces, inscriptions, dedications, and other peritextual elements of incunabula, and perhaps most entertainingly, to me at least, a reproduction of the prison accounts book entry listing both the dinner expenses of Ridley, Latimer, and Cranmer, and, in another table, the costs of burning them at the stake. The entirety of this book is excessively supplementary and precedes the publication of such miscellanies as Bartlett's Familiar Quotations by some 46 years. I recall Prof. Blamberg is not here, but I hear recall him saying something yesterday about a Chinese text composed entirely of quotations. It seems to me that in the English tradition, at least, this book is the beginning of the collection of quotations. Such collections seem to be composed entirely of dead quotations, in Bakhtin's phrase, because they do not even create accidental meaning by joining or juxtaposing their selections. Their form is that of an architectural or an architectural necropolis. Irrespective of their contents, these collections have simultaneously the morbid and elegiac atmosphere of a pathologist's museum of amputated limbs. Such residual dead quotations serve only to suggest the ruin and decay of the absent body of the texts from which they have been excised. But more familiar and more common frame narratives in the Romantic era, and even framed poems, are also marked by their peritextual elements, just as Coleridge's glosses, the famous glosses to the 1817 Sibylline Leaves edition of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner attest. He adds these mock antiquarian glosses, which render the internal quotations within the poem quotations of quotations. Similarly, Maria Edgeworth's tale of 18th century Irish life, Castle Rackrent, as published in 1800, contained a glossary explaining Irish vernacular placed on exergue, as well as a barrage of fictional editors' footnotes, all of which quite ostensibly quote ostensibly authentic oral usages of the Irish idioms for the benefit of a non-Irish readership. Such paratextual elements, both epitextual and peritextual, have been most closely outlined, of course, by Gérard Genette in his book Seuils or Paratexts, in which Genette systematizes the liminal elements of texts, their titles and prefaces, forewords and introductions, inscriptions and dedications, footnotes and endnotes, any or all of which may overtly or covertly be quotations, as, for example, is the case with William Faulkner's novel The Sound and the Fury. The one peritextual form in the novel which is always a quotation is the epigraph. Genette notes that the epigraph is generally placed on exergue, at the head of the book, or, as was the fashion in Gothic novel, even at the head of each chapter, as is the case in novels by Radcliffe, Lewis, Maturin, Scott, and Cooper. Reasoning that the epigraph's location on exergue is related to its function, Genette proposes that the habit of using quotations as epigraphs is a survival from the earlier habit of using dedicatory epistles, which served to secure the author financial favour, whether with an existing or with a wished-for benefactor. But preceding in time either dedication or epigraph, Genette suggests, was the use of the author's coat of arms, a totem which contains a textual element in itself. A coat of arms usually carries a motto, generally in Latin. Now, Genette seems aware of some implication that the location of the epigraph carries with it certain obligations derived from the form from which it evolved. He describes, for example, Victor Hugo's Hondilant as being armed with epigraphs. But he does not suggest that this pattern of evolution follows any identifiable logic. His list of functions of the epigraph, to justify and comment upon the title and text, therefore ignore in the epigraph the lost function of the preceding coat of arms, which is both an heraldic proclamation and a precautionary defensive measure asserting the authority of the writer. The epigraph as a quotation is therefore a literary skewmorph par excellence, for it retains the form, the textual motto or quotation, and it retains the location on exergue, but devolves at its most base, particularly in the popular Gothic novel, into a merely ornamental device expressing little more than the vanity of apparent learning. And here I've chosen to show you two in one, a hybrid example. There is both epigraph, or rather both epigraph and dedication containing a coat of arms here. This is again from Bibliomania, which always does everything to extremes. The coat of arms is, of course, the coat of arms not of the author, but of the Right Honourable the Earl of Powis, to whom the book is dedicated. So, to come to a conclusion. The vestigial presence of obsolete literary functions is evidence merely of an historical process of formal evolution. A catalogue of such skeuomorphs in literary study would therefore, I propose, have the rudiments of a new theory of the genesis of style, and indeed a non-human agency in the genesis of style. In the postmodern novel, the question of found materials in modern art and literature is a useful touchstone, as such artworks are often judged to be kitsch. And that's a judgment which is also often yet erroneously made of archaeological skeuomorphs. A recent trend in the novel from J.G. Ballard through Donald Barthelm to Mark Z. Danielewski and Douglas Coupland is the indecorous appropriation and quotation of purely functional written or printed materials, or what J.G. Ballard fondly calls grey literature. Computing manuals, medical reports, scientific textbooks, marketing surveys, and so on. And from the point of view of current literary analysis, these kinds of incorporations have no intrinsic meaningfulness or symbolic value. Yet modernist notions of allusion cannot account fully or satisfactorily for the ways in which these citational appropriations operate within fiction, because there exists as yet no viable aesthetic of the material in literature. I would hereby suggest that a theorization of skeuomorphism in literary form, a skeuomorphology, might provide a much more effective method of theorizing these intrusions of the material world into literature. And I think there I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much for...